Okay, so where are we? We're not in Isaiah anymore. We finished up Isaiah best we could at the end of May, and then I opened it up and said, does anybody have any ideas what we should do next? And we got mixed responses. But one that kept coming up before we did the youth ministry interviews in June was, Ben, how about you do some of that apologetic stuff? And I mostly ignored it because... two reasons. One, because my preference is always to study something out of the Bible text. Believe it or not, even though my background is in science and whatnot, I'd prefer to study with the Bible open than closed. But for the second reason, I kept getting asked about it. In my mind, I had just done some apologetic stuff, you know, like last month or something like that. And then I went back and looked, and I think it's been 6 years now. I think the last time I did an apologetics class... Here's something funny. The last time I did an apologetics class, Jacob Littlebear was here and the Cresses were here. So maybe it has been a little while. I don't know. That's irony. So I got to looking and I hadn't done anything like this in a while. So we're not going to let it go on indefinitely like we did Isaiah, where we just said we'll just finish when we finish. I'm setting a time limit on this one. We're going to do no more than 8 weeks. We'll go through the summer months. And then hopefully, hopefully the process of hiring a youth and family minister goes well, and we have somebody else in place, he and I'm sure, will have a discussion about what the future of the adult education curriculum, how it might complement what he's doing with the youth and so forth. So I was trying not to set anything in stone before he got here, whoever that might be. So we'll do just a month or two of some apologetics type things. So I thought, where to start? There are a couple of interesting places you can go in apologetics and defending our faith. We can talk about... questions of the origins of life, which is interesting to a lot of folks. We can talk about questions of the Bible. Can we trust the Bible? That's a question that comes up quite a lot. But the one I thought we would start with is, does God exist? Do we have any reason to believe that God exists? So about a year ago, I gave a lecture in Oklahoma City, and then again at OSU-IT in Okmulgee, and then again at Broken Arrow, called Does God Exist? 12 Reasons to Believe in God. And I realized I had never done it here, so tonight we're going to start that. At the three places I mentioned, I did all 12 reasons in 37 minutes. We're not doing that tonight because it involves me talking really fast and no one understanding anything. So what we'll do is we'll slow down a little bit, and things that I think are dry and boring, we'll kind of skip through and move on. Things I think are kind of interesting, we'll pause and maybe have some questions or discussion. If you have a lingering question about the existence of God, this is a great time to discuss it. Don't be intimidated by the fact that you're in a church with folks who probably do believe in God, because everybody, especially people who come to a church, have at some time or another questioned, how sure am I, and why is it that there are people who aren't as sure and don't believe, and that's totally legitimate. The old saying is people get into psychology because they're crazy, and they get into apologetics because they're not sure about anything, and they want to study and to learn, and that's certainly how I came to it. I was interested in it because I had a lot of questions, and I wasn't getting the answers I wanted, so I just kept going that direction. Suddenly, I was halfway to being an expert by asking questions, and that's a scary place to be for sure. So the first question we're going to ask, even before we get to the question of does God exist, is how do we know anything? How do we know anything? Most of our arguments that we have with other people about different topics, and I don't care if it's political, so everyone's arguing about politics this time of year between now and November, and then we'll just start over for the next 4 years and argue for 4 more years. This is what we do, we argue. Most of those discussions end up being about how do we know things. We never say that. One group is convinced one set of things is true, and the other group is convinced another set of things is true. Well, only one of them is true, maybe none of them. How do we arrive at different things that are true? Well, it's because we don't all come to know things the same way. We have this problem generationally. Parents and their kids arrive at different conclusions sometimes loudly in the living room, right? Why does that happen? Well, because they come to their conclusions differently. And then grandparents and parents and kids, now you got another step, right? In churches, we have that. In churches, we have, again, came to a certain conclusion at one point in life, and then another group that came to a conclusion at another point in life. How do we know anything? Aristotle says it like this, and this is a technical quote, but just we'll parse it down. All instruction given or received by way of argument proceeds from pre-existent knowledge. And what he means by that is, if you want to argue something, You've got to agree on a step one. Okay? If you and I can't agree on, literally cannot agree on anything, if we have zero common ground, then we can't have any kind of discussion about the existence of God or anything, the existence of grass or the existence of humans or whatever topic you want, is the sky blue. If we have zero common ground, then we have a real problem having those discussions. And this is one of the problems, whether we're talking about Bruce's work in evangelism and outreach or apologetics, one of the first problems we have as Christians is finding where is the common ground where we can both start here and say, well, we both agree on this, don't we? Is that getting harder and harder? In decades past, your neighbor and your neighbor's neighbor probably thought a lot the same way you did about certain topics. Do we find that to be true anymore? Before we moved, when we were living, where am I? I got lost. That way. When we were living over here in Jinx for a while in the lease house, just right down the street, literally my neighbors, two doors down, was a very polite lesbian couple that lived there in that home. Now, they came to some conclusions differently than I did, didn't they? What do we have in common? That's hard to find a place to start, isn't it? When gender itself is a question. And now, a few years later, transgender is an issue that's in the news, where it's not just homosexuality, it's not knowing what gender a person is, let alone two. So that's just one example of where people have very radically different points of view, and they start in different places. So it's getting harder, it feels like, I don't know if it really is, but it feels like it's getting harder to find common ground with other people to have these conversations, whether it's about does God exist or do you believe in Jesus Christ. Used to, when we did the door-knocking campaigns, right? Raise your hand if you have at some point been on a door-knocking campaign, church-related, at some point in your life. Yeah, that's what I thought, right? The reason folks used to do that is because there was a time when they were very successful, or at least more successful than they are now. That you knocked on a person's door, that person probably believed the Bible, at least in a nominal sense of, yeah, okay, I believe in the Bible. You knock on a person's door now, assuming they don't slam it in your face because they think you're strange. Do they believe in the Bible? Do they believe in God? Do they believe in Jesus? Do they believe in Western ethics or morality or anything like that? I don't know. Maybe not. So finding common ground is a lot harder. Where is our starting point? The challenge then is in determining the existence of God is that it requires a person to first determine what evidence is admissible. And I put the lowercase g on purpose because this would be true for any god. If you were trying to prove the existence of Zeus, you'd have the same problem, right? How do you prove the existence of, I don't know, Allah or whoever? How would you do that? You have the same problem. You got to find common ground somewhere and say, well, if you believe in that, then I can make a point and you'll believe in this now. And all of our evangelism and all of our apologetics works that way. You go read the first two or three century of Christian evangelism and apologetics, and you know what they're doing? Well, if you believe in the Old Testament, then you should believe in Jesus as Israel's Messiah. Because they were talking to Jewish folks, and that was the common ground. When they go to the Gentile world, in Acts chapter 17, for example, Paul goes to Athens. He never quotes the Old Testament once. But he quotes two Greek philosophers. Does he believe the Greek philosophers are Scripture? No. But he believes the Greeks like him. So he quotes some Greek philosophers. He says, your philosopher says this. This, if you'll agree with that, you should believe in this. The quote he gives is, we are all his offspring. Remember that from Acts 17? We are all his offspring. That's a quote from a book about Zeus. And Paul quotes that and says, well, if we're all his offspring, then God can't be made of stone because I'm not. If you believe in that, then you need to believe in this. Let me tell you about Jesus. See? So that's the challenge we have. So that's why in this particular lesson, I have what I'm calling 12 different approaches to God. Ben, why don't you just pick one that works for everybody and tell everybody, this is it, believe this argument, use it on everybody. Because for some people, one of these arguments, I'll make it, and you'll say, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then there's a person next to you, the person right next to you that you think you know is going to say, oh, that's really good. That made a lot of sense to me. And then the next one, it'll be the reverse. In these 12 arguments are some arguments I don't like. then why would you present arguments you don't like? Because I recognize there are other people to whom it makes a lot of sense. And so I at least offer it, and then at times I'll put my disclaimer on it. Here's why I don't like it. But I at least present it to you so you've heard it, and it might be some use to you. Okay, so let's move on then to number one. One approach to God actually gets around the whole question of how do you prove God by saying, why do you need to prove anything? And do you prove everything? W.K. Clifford lived a couple hundred years ago and was an atheist. And he liked to tell a story about a guy who owned a ship. I actually have it here, but I was looking over it, and it's kind of technical. I don't want to read it. Anyway, I'll summarize it. He says, imagine a person has a ship, and he sets it to sail. He's a merchant, and it's going to go out and take some cargo to a port and then come back. And there's crew, of course, on the ship, and some people that work for him are on the ship. And someone says to him, are you sure that ship is seaworthy? And he says, well, I'm pretty sure. But he doesn't check it out. The ship goes out into the harbor, and it sinks, and everyone dies. What would you say to the man about the ship? You can answer that. Well, what would you say to the man who owned the ship? Should have checked it out. Okay. You're being kind of negligent, right? Someone rose a concern, and you didn't bother to check, and people died because of it. That's your fault. So what Clifford says is, he makes a point then about God, and he says, it is wrong always, everywhere, for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. That's his claim. He says, if you can't prove it, you have no right to believe it. If someone says to you, I think your ship is not seaworthy, you have no right to put it out in the harbor until you've checked every last peg in that ship. Okay? And then, as an atheist, what's his next move? He says, that's the problem with you God-believing folks, you Christians. You believe in God, but where's the evidence? Where's the proof? You're like a guy who sends a ship out and hasn't tested it. I'm asking you, where's the proof? And you haven't got an answer, see? And that's Clifford's concern. What's the problem with Clifford's claim? It sounds really good, right? It's a natural conclusion. When I first heard this story, Lenora, I gave the exact same answer you did. I said, well, that shipbuilder, he's in trouble. Do we do that in real life, though? Do we check every facet of everything we do every time we do it? Your brakes might be bad right now. You might get in your car on the way home, your brakes give out, and you kill somebody. Is anyone going to run out in the parking lot and check all the brakes? Why don't we do that? Every time we start the car, why don't we pull all the plugs and take a look at the brakes and check the tire pressure every time? Why do we take for granted that the car is probably in the same shape we left it? Past performance? Yeah, okay, so we trust it. We say, worked last time, it seemed like it might work this time. So what my point is that Clifford's statement, it's wrong always, everywhere, for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence, that would make a very busy and confusing life, wouldn't it? If every time you picked something up, you had to say, well, I know it looks like paper, but what if it's not paper? I guess I'd better check to make sure it's paper. And it looks like English, but I'm not sure if it's English. What if it's actually some foreign code? I better check. What if we checked everything every time? What if we checked Clifford's statement? It is wrong always, everywhere, for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. What's the evidence for Clifford's statement? How do you know that's true? Clifford just said it was true. Ta-da! It's not like it's written in the sky somewhere. The fact is, we believe a lot of things every single day based on no evidence at all. And this is what philosophers call a basic belief. Okay? Basic belief. And let me give you some examples. Are your parents your parents? Now, everyone here knows of some examples where somebody's parents that raised them weren't actually their parents. They had adopted a child and never told them. Everyone, raise your hand. Everyone know a story. Do you know a story where someone was adopted and didn't know it till later in life? Yeah, okay, so we've heard of that, okay? Could your parents have adopted you? Now, you can do a DNA test. How many of you have done a DNA test to see if your parents are actually your parents? How many of you at the age of 5 got up in the morning before breakfast and plucked some hair out of their head and said, I've got to go check this, Mom, I'll be back? Never. None of you. It's a properly basic belief. You could be wrong, but it's such an outside chance. It's properly basic to say, you know, they're the people feeding me breakfast. They're the people who take care of me. They were there every morning when I woke up and every night when I went to bed. I think they're my parents. And that's a properly basic belief. And no one thinks you're crazy for believing that. Is this air you're breathing? I mean, does it come with labels, does it? Now, we could do a test. We could check all of the oxygen in this room in between every breath. You hold your breath and I'll do the test. Take a deep breath and then we'll test it again. We don't do that. Why not? Past performance? Everywhere else I've ever gone, every other church building I've been to had oxygen, so I'm guessing this one probably does too, right? And I don't think all the oxygen's going to hop to that side of the room and starve me over here of oxygen and suffocate me. Properly basic belief. Is there any evidence for that? Not scientifically, not that kind of evidence. In fact, if you want to go take a physics class, it's remotely possible that all the oxygen molecules in a room would hop to one side. It's unlikely, to say the least, but it's possible. They're randomly moving around. They could all just be on that side for today. Why don't we worry about that? You lose any sleep over that one? I never have. Even after the guy in class told me it was possible, never lost any sleep over it. Properly basic belief. There are some things you're just allowed to believe. How do you know you're in Glenpool, Oklahoma? Well, there's a sign out there that says Glenpool. I could put Glenpool on the back of this piece of paper. Does that make this Glenpool? I could take it to Mars. Well, you know, okay. Properly basic belief. How do you know the Earth is round? You've never been on the moon. Now, I've seen pictures. But I can Photoshop stuff. I can put Elvis on the moon if you want. I mean, we can make a picture, show whatever you want. So you see my point? It's a silly set of arguments, but that's the point. Is that in everyday life, there are things you take for granted and don't require extensive proof for. So one of the ways to come to God is to ask the question, is it even possible that God doesn't need proof? Now, this is just one approach, but it's one that's worth thinking about. If there was a being who created the entire universe, who sustained the existence of all life and all matter every second of every day, would it be a basic belief to believe in him? Might it be, if that were true, the other side that needed argument more than me? One of the world's leading philosophers, Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame, put out a book in the 80s called God and Other Minds. And his point was, how do you know that somebody else has a mind? That was his favorite example. Some of you are thinking, I don't know how Ben has a mind right now. How do I know that Jim Yeager has a mind? Now, I can cut his head open and find his brain. How do I know he has a mind? How do I know that he experiences joy like I do? Or that when he smashes his finger, it hurts like it hurts when I smash my finger? How do I know that he loves Susan? How do I know that he likes some other thing? How do I know how he feels about being a fireman? See these questions? How do I know he has a mind? By definition, I'm just in my own head. I can't be in yours. So how do I know you're out there? Any of you lose sleep over that? No. Nobody in a sane world walks around wondering, I wonder if the person I'm talking to really exists. There's an old philosopher joke about the professor who believed he was the only real person, everyone else was imaginary. And his graduate students always said, we really take care of him because when he goes, we all go. No sane person walks through life thinking, I wonder if everybody else is imaginary. And that was Plantinga's point. Why do you believe in anybody else? You can't really prove it, can you? If you really wanted to be completely antagonistic and set out lots of questions, could you prove that anybody else has a mind? It'd be tough. He says, but we were willing to believe that other people have minds, so why can't we believe that God is there? Why can't that be the same kind of thing? And he makes a fair point. So here's the summary of the argument, just to get through it. Somebody says, well, you've got to prove that scientifically, absolutely. You've got to show me the test tube full of God before I'll believe anything. Just remind them that there are lots of things you believe every day with a lot less evidence than that. And that should at least give them pause. Does that solve the problem? Does that prove there is a God? In my mind, it doesn't. But at least raises the question, doesn't it, that what do you mean by proof, a test tube full of God? What does that even mean? Was it the cosmonaut that got out above the Earth's atmosphere for the first time and said, I looked around and there's no God? What kind of proof is that? He didn't see Neptune either, but it's there. All right, so first thing we have to ask is, what do we count as proof? And I think this is a fair question to ask. Any questions on what we mean by just a basic belief? Sir? Larry, yeah. It's a common source if you believe in the Bible, yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't have a common source,
yeah.
Everybody, opinions are like noses.
Opinions are like noses. Everyone's got one. Yeah, and so that's what makes this nice, is that nearly everybody you meet, here's some common ground for you. Nearly everyone you meet believes their parents are their parents, and the air they breathe is the air they breathe, and the person next to them is not make-believe. Okay? Not Harvey the Rabbit. Well, that's some common ground, and you just start there. Do you believe in anything? Well, sure, I believe in some things. Why do you believe in anything? And when they give you their answer, you say, well, there's at least that much evidence for God. So that's one way to start. Okay, number two. These all have fantastically long technical names. Don't be frightened. It's to sell more books, I'm sure. Number two is called the cosmological argument. And it just comes from a word that's in your Bible, actually, in the Greek text, cosmos. And it means the arrangement of things. So here's kind of how it goes. Whatever has a beginning of existence must have a cause. The universe began to exist. The universe must have been caused to exist. Okay? So what's the common ground here? Well, number one, do you think we're really here? Again, you may find somebody who says, I'm not so sure about that. And with that person, I'm going to give you permission. Bruce and I and the evangelism group are going to give you permission. If someone says, I'm not sure I'm really here, you can move on to the next door, okay? Because that one's going to be a hard sell. But for anybody who believes that they're actually there, and there is actually a universe and we live in it, then we can, okay, there is a universe. Did it begin? Did the universe begin? Forget that you've ever read the Bible. I know it's hard. But forget you've ever read the Bible. Did the universe begin? Okay. Yeah. No, yeah, that's a legitimate point, and that's very interesting. Back in the ancient world, people thought the universe had always been here. So I quoted Aristotle a moment ago. Aristotle thought the world's always been here. So for Aristotle, you don't tell him the world began because he said, oh, it's always been here. And this argument wouldn't work on Aristotle. So if you ever meet Aristotle, don't use it on him. But for anybody in the last century, for the first time in human history, science completely switched its view and decided that the universe did have a beginning. Now, they want it to be 13.8. 13.8 billion, I think. It was 13.7 when I was in college, and it's only been it's only been 10 years, people. And already it's ticked up a little bit. Every time they do a study, they add a few million. A few million here and there. Eventually we're talking about real time. So, yeah, I think it's 13.8, but they believe it's way back there in the past. But science believes right now that the universe had a beginning. And what is it called? Big Bang, okay. Big Bang is a model, a scientific theory, scientific model for the beginning of all reality, okay? You don't have to argue with them. We're looking for common ground, right? We're not looking for things we disagree on. We got plenty of those. We're looking for common ground. We're not going to talk about how long or how or what. We're just going to ask this question, did it start? And whether it's 13.8 or whatever number you like, the answer is yes, it started. Which is, again, a really phenomenal thing in the last 100 years that has come into existence. The person who came up with the Big Bang model was a priest. Yeah, he was Catholic. He was a Catholic priest. Lemaitre was his name. And he was motivated by the idea, he was bothered that as a scientist, he was being taught the world had always been here. And he says, my Bible says otherwise, and went out looking for a beginning. Now, we might, again, disagree with some of his conclusions, but it was a Jesuit who came to the conclusion, Lemaitre, that is now the Big Bang model of things. It was a Christian person, a believing person, who said, I believe the Bible, so the universe must have a beginning, so let's go look for that. So science, for once in history, agrees with us on this one point. The universe started. Okay, so that's point number one, or number two, rather. The universe began to exist. Okay, is number one true? Whatever has a beginning of existence must have a cause. Is that true? Is there anything that starts being without something making it be? That's a serious question in modern science today. In modern science, in quantum theory, you can get a spontaneous separation of a matter and antimatter pair, and then more than likely they're going to come back together and annihilate themselves. But yeah, you can get some funny, weird, random-y kind of things to happen. But by and large, what is our experience with the universe? Things happen because somebody made it happen. That's normal. Things don't pop into existence right and left, do they? When you were about 6 months old, you learned that. And I mean, I'm not just being facetious. You really did. It's one of the first things children learn with their parents. Everybody here probably played this game with your child where you take a toy and you put a blanket over it, and the six-month-old goes, right? Because they can't see it anymore, and in their mind, it's winked out of existence. And then you go, here it is, or you pull it out from behind your back, and they think you have created a toy out of nothingness. Okay? And this is a great game for 6 months old. How old are you before you figure out, oh, it just went behind his back? Yeah, about 7 months. It's like the first thing children learn is that things don't just wink into existence and then pop out of existence. The magician, this is going to break everyone's heart, the magician doesn't really pull the rabbit out of that hat. Okay, the rabbit was there to start with. We don't just invent things out of nowhere, poof, and they're there. Okay, in fact, how do things normally happen? Normally, if something happens surprisingly that's unexpected, I mean, if this is a room. During the week, there's no one in this room. It just sits here. And all the chairs are exactly where you left them. Okay? Now, one Sunday, you come in, and instead of nice, neat rows, they're arranged in concentric circles with the pulpit in the middle. What would you assume? Ben has gone crazy. That's right. Pulpit's right in the middle. Yeah, you would not assume even that natural forces did that, not because of the orderliness of it, just because anything happened. In normal everyday life, if something happened, something caused it. And the most normal thing to cause things is choice or will, right? If I want to lift my left hand, I lift my left hand, and it goes up, and then I say, come down, and it comes down. Okay, so the universe didn't exist, and then it did. What in our ordinary human experience might cause that to happen? Well, some kind of act of will. Someone with sufficient power making an act of will could cause that to happen. Without that, do we have any example where something pops into existence without reason, cause, or act of will? Can't really think of much. So that's one reason. I think that's pretty interesting. What's neat about this one is there are hints of it in the Bible. Where it became really popular was in medieval Islamic philosophy, believe it or not. The most famous version of this is called the Kalam cosmological argument, and it comes from Islam. There's also a Jewish version of it that you can find in Jewish antiquity, and there's a Christian version of it that you can find in Christian history. But virtually all religious people, at the end of the day, go back to this one because it works. There's something here. How'd it get here is a fair question, and no one has done a terrific job of settling that. What usually happens is we end up in a debate on nothing. That's a funny thing. You ought to listen to some of these debates on nothing. The atheist says, well, the Big Bang caused the beginning of everything. Okay, what caused the Big Bang? Well, essentially nothing. What is essentially nothing? Well, it's basically nothing. What is basically nothing? Well, it's very, 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 very tiny stuff. Well, tiny stuff is not nothing. There was one guy once upon a time who wrote an article, serious scientist, and said that the universe began with about 20 pounds of nearly nothing. I'm going to hit him in the head with a 20-pound hammer of nearly nothing and see what he thinks about it. I mean, it's a silly idea that no matter what, whether you call it quantum foam or some kind of physical term or whatever it is, if it's a thing, then it's something. Okay, and so it's put it back in the beginning. Okay, did it start? If it started, someone made it start. So whatever it is, it got here somehow. Nothing means nothing. Okay. Any questions on argument number two? And kind of the strengths or weaknesses of that? Matt Hamilton, I know, has a question about the multiverse. Are you ready to? No? Okay. Yeah. I have lots of notes on the multiverse, but no one ever asked that question. It's okay. All the nerdy things I learned in college are so useless now. No one ever asks. I got great long papers on neutrino mass. No one cares. Okay. Number three, then, and this will probably wrap us up for tonight. This one, again, is another one that it's kind of rooted in a Bible concept, though we don't quote Bible to make the point. The fancy name is teleological argument from the Greek term teleos. Every time you see the word perfect in your Bible, in your New Testament, it is probably from the Greek term teleos, which means a complete thing, a mature thing. A thing that looks like it has a function. It looks like it has a purpose. Okay? So a Christian becomes perfect, thoroughly furnished into every good work. Teleos. You are designed to do a job. And that's recognizable in a Christian. This is what 2 Timothy chapter 3 says. Well, how would this apply to the argument of the universe and whether there is a God? Well, if reality, number one, exhibits evidence of purpose and intent, and that purposeful intent is very unlikely to have arisen through random or unguided processes, then it's reasonable to conclude that this intent was the result of a purposeful choice to embed intent in reality. So let's look at those one at a time because there's a lot of words there. Do we find things in our world that have the evidence of purpose and intent? Are there things in the universe that do something? That are arranged, see, I'm even using prejudicial language. It's hard to even say it without using designed or something like that. That have a shape and are made of such material that accomplishes a task. I mean, in the natural world, leaves on trees. Parking lot works pretty good. Yeah, parking lot works pretty good. Parking lot's a good human example, okay? So if you see a parking lot, and you see stripes out there, and the stripes are equidistant from each other, right? And they look kind of uniform. They're all at the same angle. Now, if you see them all crooked out there, you think Lucas got out there with a spray can. But if you see them all lined up, neat little rows, what does your brain immediately interpret it to mean? Someone wants me to do something here. It's about the size of a car. Someone wants me to park a car here. And your brain figures all that out, doesn't even ask you. I bet we've had a couple of show of hands. I won't do this one. I bet you I could ask you for a show of hands. All the people who have come to a parking lot and wondered what it was for. I'm betting nobody does, right? Because your brain just does the math. It's actually hardwired into human brain and intellect to recognize patterns wherever we see it. We see a pattern and we immediately start asking, what's it doing? What's it doing? Which is why when people started discovering DNA, and the arrangement of the proteins in DNA, no one thought that was just a random set of filaments. They said, what's it doing? What's it doing? And the brain started doing the math. And they started to see sensibility in it. The DNA has a function. DNA is complicated. It is obscenely complicated. One metaphor that's been used is DNA is not like a blueprint. DNA is like a blueprint that builds the house. And in the house are rooms that build more blueprints. That's how complex DNA is. It's not just carrying information like in a book. It's a book that does what the book says and then produces more books to do more things. And your body is just oodled with it, every fiber of hair. Okay. William Paley, he gets made fun of now. He's old-fashioned. He's from the 1800s as well. And his metaphor was a watch. And you may have even heard this example. If you're walking along the British beach, because of course he's British, walking along the British beach somewhere and you find a pocket watch and you pick it up, what do you assume? Somebody lost it because somebody made it, right? I mean, this is not a natural coral formation, right? You don't look and say, there's a coral reef there that tells time. You don't look at it and say, that's a really peculiar seashell, even. You don't say, that's a funny arrangement of sand, even though, I mean, what's a pocket watch? Just made of the same stuff that's in the sand, right? Why don't you think that? Paley says, because you recognize you got these very precise set of gears. It has function. It does something. And when you see something that does something, that looks neat and orderly, your brain starts doing the math instantaneously. And you say, what is that? And you start comparing it to things you know. And your brain says, I know what that is. It does something. Somebody made that. Paley says, when I look at the universe, I see the same thing. Okay? It looks like it has the same regimented system to it. It's doing something. The earth spins. Seasons come and go. Things are regular. Babylonians wanted to count how many days were in a year. They came up with 365, and they didn't have decimal places, so they didn't have a leap day. Why are there still 365 days in a year? Turns out it works. I mean, that's the system. It just does its thing, okay? Humans keep being humans, okay? We had no concern whatsoever that we would have our second child and it would be a fish, right? Because of the regularity of nature, that the human anatomy is designed to produce another human. And it does this based on the mechanisms that are involved in it. And they're incredible. You're just in awe when you see that first sonogram picture and you think, how is that possible that a human being is inside of a human being? And there it is. Okay, so this is a fair point. Do you look at the universe and do you see anything that seems like it does something? Is it fair to say that things that do something are created by people who wanted something done? In our experience, that's the case. What's the responses to that? Richard Dawkins would say, well, it's based on your bad evolution. You're evolutionary produced beings, and you're hardwired to look for a design where it doesn't exist, and it's just, sorry, it's wrong with your brain. You can't help but see it. To me, that's a self-defeating argument. If your only argument against the argument is, well, your brain doesn't work right, all the conclusions of your brain are wrong, then why would I believe the conclusions of your brain that tell me that my conclusions of my brain are wrong? Because it means your brain is messed up too. But that's essentially, if you read The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, essentially his argument is that evolution has hardwired into the human brain a predisposition to see pixies in the grass and gods in the trees, and you know, you just look for gods everywhere. Your brain's wrong. Well, that means his brain is wrong too, and I'm reading his book. So to me, that's a problem. Out of 12, we covered 3. So that'll get you started. Food for thought. Next week, we'll do some more. If you have any input on specific apologetic questions you have, can I trust the Bible, other type questions, let me know, and I'll try to make a night for those somewhere this summer before we wrap up. Thanks.